But others, like Zhavrailov, enlisted with an eye for both gaining combat experience and exacting revenge on their ancient enemy. Zhavrailov had met Berkich 4 years before, when Berkich recruited him into his organization. Secured communications had enabled them to formulate their plan for the stolen missiles. Berkich clapped him on the shoulder. "Come, my young lion. Show me this miracle you have brought." Chapter 23. Zhavrailov led Berkich and Emir to the far side of the building, where they found Walib hunched over a workbench, a wisp of smoke curling up from a soldering iron in his hand. On the table beside him was a 4-inch diameter electro-optical turret for the hand-launched, eagle-sized Elbit System Skylark 1 LE UAV, which stood assembled on another elevated table a few feet away, stolen from the Russian arsenal as well.
"Captain, I want you to meet my commander, Tariq Berkich."
The mustachioed Syrian turned around, a smudge of solder on his cheek. His eyes were black with fatigue, but his smile was genuine. Marrying the Grad's ancient launch platform to the portable fire control computer he'd brought in the Pelican case was taking more time and energy than he'd anticipated. He was having to improvise quite a bit. The Grad's rifled launch tubes spun the rockets like a bullet to improve flight stability and accuracy. The trajectory of a rocket's flight and its ultimate destination were determined by elevation and azimuth angles, along with the duration of engine fire, warhead weight, distance, wind speed, and a dozen other factors. Fortunately, most of these factors were known and fixed, and the variables could be measured or calculated, and all of it accounted for in the brain of the fire control computer.
"Commander, this is Captain Walib, the Syrian Arab Army's finest rocket forces officer."
Walib extended a small, confident hand. Berkich took it.
"Aslan has told me all about you, Commander."
"And he has spoken well of you, Captain," Berkich said. He broke into a grin and pulled Walib into a bear hug and clapped him on the back, then released him from his massive embrace, but kept a firm grip on Walib's hand and a big paw on his shoulder. The commander's good eye brightened.
"Welcome to Bosnia. Thanks be to God for your safe travels. You have come very far. Without Aslan, I never would have made it. Without God, neither of us would have," Zhavrailov was quick to add.
The journey had taken longer than expected, partly to avoid the Russians, who'd managed to pick up their trail early on. Berkich stepped closer to the workbench.
"How close are you to completion?" "I have everything I need, but the work requires precision and is time-consuming."
The big Chechen bent close to the soldered electrical components, examining them with his one good eye.
"We only have 9 days to prepare, and there are still other pieces we need to put in place. I have already checked out the flight systems on the Skylark. Of course, it's an Israeli unit, so it's in perfect condition."
"Israeli?" Berkich asked.
"They make the best equipment, so naturally the Russians buy their drones from them or copy them." "I thought the Americans made the best drones, like the Predator."
"Interesting that you mentioned the Predator. It was the first drone the CIA used in live combat reconnaissance, and the first place they flew it was in the Bosnian War.
That experience is what began the modern drone revolution. But the Predator was invented by an Israeli engineer who emigrated to America to start his company. The Predator is a great machine, and Abraham Kerem will go down in history as one of the great inventors."
Berkich's darkening face told Walib what the Chechen thought about Jewish engineers. The Syrian pressed on.
"The Skylark is a portable unit, hand-launched, quiet, and fully automated, with a 3-hour flight time for its electric engine. 2 men can set it up in the field and launch it within 8 minutes.
"Shafiq has trained me how to do it," Zhavrailov said, smiling. "I'm a drone pilot now, though in truth, the operation is mostly automated."
"What is the purpose of the drone?" Berkich asked. "We know the GLONASS coordinates of the target."
"Aslan will paint the target with the onboard laser. The Starfire missiles are equipped with a laser guidance system, which is the most accurate guidance system available. It drops the CEP, circular error probable, to less than 1 meter. Practically a sniper rifle, Shabrailov said. Berkich's white eye flared. But lasers don't work in bad weather.
The weather forecast is sunny and cloudless for launch day, Walib said.
But weather changes, especially around here. In case there is a problem, each missile is also equipped with a GLONASS guidance system. Also more than accurate enough for our purposes, with a CEP of less than 13 meters.
Like Uber, but for missiles, Emir asked.
Walib smiled.
Perhaps, but at least with these, you don't have to tip the driver.
And what if the GLONASS system fails? Berkich asked.
Highly unlikely, sir.
Humor me, Captain.
Then there is an onboard inertial navigation system, computerized gyroscopes and accelerometers. No guarantees at that point we will hit the target, but even so, we will land close enough to cause enormous casualties.
Computerized, huh?
And what if that fails as well?
Three system failures.
It isn't possible, Shabrailov said.
Berkich jabbed a finger on the larger man's chest.
In war, anything is possible, especially the unexpected.
Your commander is right. Technology can fail.
Walib nodded at the big green 6x6 truck.
I first trained on the ground system. It's old technology, but reliable. The rocket motors are reliable and the fuel burn rates are known quantities.
A straight launch, with no electronic guidance systems at all, will still result in a satisfactory strike. Think of it as a very long-range, very effective mortar system.
We cannot fail, Emir said.
Berkich nodded, satisfied.
So, everything is ready.
Not yet. The next thing I'm doing is taking the extra precaution to confirm that the laser wavelength on the Skylark's laser designator is synced with the laser guidance computer on board each of the Starfire missiles.
Excellent. Leave nothing to chance.
What else is there?
Once the missiles are programmed and synced to the portable fire control computer, we should move the launcher to the location we talked about, much closer to the target. The shorter the range, the better. Once the launcher is fixed in place, I will need to make fine gun-laying adjustments to the launcher by hand, using the Grad's mechanical traverse wheels on the stabilized platform for azimuth and elevation in milliradians. It won't be necessary to be more precise than that. The laser and GLONASS guidance will more than make up for any mechanical error.
It will be a day of judgment, a glorious victory for the Dar al-Salam, Shabrailov said.
That is not for us to decide, Berkich cautioned. All we can do is work and pray.
He turned to Walib and pounded his narrow shoulder.
But thanks to you, the work will be easier, and the prayers lighter.
There is a reason why God brought the two of you together, Shabrailov said. Your vision, Commander, and your expertise, Captain. How can we fail?
Inshallah, Emir said.
As soon as we have all of the missiles, I can finish the other work.
Berkich frowned.
What work is that?
Walib pointed to the open pelican case on the floor. It contained the portable fire control computer he'd also stolen from the Russian armory.
With that unit, I can pre-program the exact coordinates and elevation of the target on each missile, which is critical. In my studies at the Russian Artillery Academy, they taught us that back in 1999, during the Yugoslav wars, the American GPS-guided JDAM bombs slammed into the Chinese embassy in Belgrade because the wrong targeting coordinates had been inputted.
Berkich grinned.
So, the Americans make mistakes.
Walib shrugged.
At least that was the Americans' official explanation.
Of course, other sources indicate it was intentional, because they believed the Serb White Tigers were being directed out of that building.
Fortunately for us, our target is permanently fixed, and its exact geo-coordinates are widely available on the Internet. No accidents are possible as far as the GLONASS targeting system is concerned, let alone the laser.
Excellent. The computerized fire control system also allows me to perform hardware and software checks before launch.
So far,
Everything I've tested has been in perfect working condition, so I anticipate no problems with the other units when they arrive. If you need anything, come to me directly, Berkic told the Syrian. You are the top priority. Everything we have is yours. What I need most is time, Walib said, and the rest of those missiles. Of course. Berkic turned to Emir. Walk with me.
Berkic and Emir exited the warehouse and headed for the trees for privacy. When they were out of earshot, the Chechen asked, When do you expect the next shipment to arrive? The small Bosniak shook his head. Tomorrow night. And the rest?
The day after, or perhaps two.
I don't like these delays, Berkic said.
It can't be helped. The rumors of Russians in country aren't just rumors.
SVR? Berkic asked, incredulous. The Russian version of the CIA.
Perhaps, perhaps not. I myself spoke with a driver who was stopped only last night.
Names, faces, anything we can use.
Only that he heard Russian spoken.
Emir grinned. He still reeked of his own urine. He thought for sure they would kill him.
I'm surprised they didn't.
Berkic scratched his beard. Did you contact your friend in the police? Tell them about these Russian spies running around. That might help our cause.
Emir shrugged. Our police friend laughed.
A murdered truck driver.
Yes, that would get things moving. But a stopped truck, with no one injured and nothing taken. Who cares?
But they are Russians on Bosnian soil.
These Russian devils are smart. Keeping a low profile gives them freedom of movement and keeps the police disinterested.
How did the Russians even find out about this?
We don't know.
Emir shrugged again.
Of course, someone could have told them.
Who?
Walib?
The Syrian?
We don't really know him.
But Aslan swears by him, and I swear by Aslan. Besides, if it was the Syrian, what is there for him to gain?
To track us down, disrupt our operations, kill our leadership.
Then we would already be dead, wouldn't we?
He's here.
The Chechen pointed a scarred finger toward the distant road.
And the Russians are still out there.
He shook his head. No, it was God who brought us the Syrian and his missiles, not the Russians.
Emir nodded submissively.
Yes, of course.
Do whatever you must to get the rest of those missiles delivered here, and tell me when they arrive.
Emir nodded.
God's will be done.
Chapter 24 Hendley Associates, Alexandria, Virginia. Jerry Hendley sat at his spotless desk in his top-floor office, squinting behind his reading glasses as he scrolled through the minutes of the latest European Central Bank meeting from the Bloomberg newsfeed on his desktop. As director of one of the most successful privately held financial services firms in the world, he had the responsibility of staying on top of global macroeconomic news, but he employed an army of talented analysts to handle the day-to-day tactical decisions of stock trades, arbitrage plays, and other client services. The former senator liked to dress the part of the financial mogul, whether in the office or not, but today he was headed for lunch with the ranking minority leader of the Senate Finance Committee, an old colleague and bridge partner. For the occasion, he wore a crisp, starched white dress shirt with French cuffs and a blue silk tie. To complement his full head of perfectly coiffed silver hair, he wore a silver Rolex watch, sterling silver medallion cufflinks, and a matching silver tie bar, all offset by a charcoal-gray pinstriped Brooks Brothers suit. A soft knock at the door caught his attention.
Come in.
The door pushed open, and Gavin Beery stumbled in, holding his iPad in his trembling, over-caffeinated hands. His bloodshot eyes were rimmed with exhaustion after an all-nighter fueled by a steady flow of monster drinks, peanut M&Ms and Cheetos. Wrinkled beige chinos and a crumb-dusted blue polo rounded out his disheveled casual ensemble.
Hi, Jerry. You set for me?
Hendley suppressed a smile. He hadn't hired Gavin for his sartorial splendor, but rather for his impeccable brain. Gavin was the IT manager for both Hendley Associates and the campus, and also Jerry's best hacker. Jerry set his reading glasses down and pointed to the overstuffed chair in front of his desk. Pull up a chair and take a load off, son.
Thanks.
Gavin smiled weakly and fell into the leather wingback, ignoring the springs groaning under his weight. Jerry put his computer to sleep.
I saw your email. Somewhat cryptic, but it sounded urgent.
Well, I don't know about urgent. Interesting, maybe.
You've got my attention. Shoot.
Gavin shifted around in his chair. So is Jack still going to press charges against that Elena Iliescu woman?
Last time I talked to him, yes. Can't say that I blame him, especially after the ice chest revelation.
Yeah, that was creepy for sure. Did she press charges against him yet?
Strangely, no. I just got off the phone with the lawyer we hired for Jack. She thinks Iliescu is holding off, hoping that Jack will drop his charges against her.
A Mexican standoff, Gavin said. Then he caught himself.
Is it okay to say that?
Who the hell knows anymore? Jerry leaned forward on his desk. Why don't you fill me in on the details of your email? So, just like the Slovenian police told Jack, the woman is squeaky clean. No priors, no Interpol notices, not even a ticket for jaywalking. I mean, I don't know if jaywalking's a crime over there. I've never been to...
Jerry waved a grandfatherly hand. Go ahead, son. Get on with it.
Well, anyway, I wanted to double-check her background myself, and so I broke into the Interpol network.
You what?
No worries. I've done it before, and I'm buried behind a Tor browser and a couple remote VPNs.
Jerry sighed. His IT director might as well have been chatting in Urdu with all of his technical mumbo-jumbo. But that's why he hired Gavin in the first place. He was the best. He could hack into virtually any computer, anywhere, and hide from just about anybody.
Go on. So I checked the retinal scan she has on file with Interpol, the one that gets checked when she passes through EU customs.
And?
All clear.
But you said you found something.
Don't ask me why, but I got a bug up my nose and I decided to pull up the retinal scan Jack sent me from the crime scene.
And?
And the funny thing is, the scan Jack sent doesn't match the Interpol scan.
How can that be?
I can think of a couple things, but it all boils down to the fact that somehow she's managed to get her actual retina scan to convert to a clean dummy file within the Interpol system that makes her look like Mother Teresa. Which made me think, of course, that maybe she isn't. Especially since Mother Teresa was Albanian and not, please, Gavin, stay focused. I've got a lot on my plate today.
Yeah, sorry.
Gavin yawned like a hippo.
Sorry, I'm running on fumes.
No worries.
So where was I?
The real versus fake retina scan.
Oh, yeah. So that isn't easy to do, spoofing a major database like that. Somebody's got some chops. Or insider access.
Interesting. The next thing I decided to do was take another run at her in some of the other databases I have access to.
Such as?
It's better if you don't know. I mean, legally.
Humor me.
Well, I took a gander at Tide. She isn't listed there.
How the hell did you break into Tide?
Jerry couldn't believe it. The Terrorist Identities Data Mart environment was one of the most highly classified databases in the intelligence community, shared by the CIA, FBI, NSA, and every other alphabet agency he could think of.
I'd rather not say, but it's what you hire me to do.
You're right. So what did you find in your other searches besides Tide?
Nothing to write home about. She always came up squeaky clean. She's some sort of a consultant,
Lots of international travel, lots of airline and hotel miles, mostly in Europe. I checked her tax records. She has a steady income, but with irregular bumps. Some kind of bonus structure is my guess.
You got her tax records?
Gavin shrugged.
Sure. No big deal.
Did you find out her favorite brand of toothpaste?
Gavin frowned and pulled up a screen on his tablet.
I didn't realize you needed that. Let me see if I can find it.
I'm joking, son. Sorry to interrupt your train of thought. Please continue.
So I started digging into the consulting firm she works for. Again, clean, nothing unusual or suspicious. Except that the firm sometimes billed for work with one particular company with a Jersey office.
You mean the state or the country?
The country.
A banking haven, Jerry said. One of the 10 dwarfs.
Exactly. So I dug a little further on that and got the names of the board of directors of that Jersey company, and one of them is a British citizen.
Well, I have access to an MI6 back door you probably shouldn't know about. It turns out that this director fellow is suspected of being somehow connected to an organization known as the Iron Syndicate.
Jerry frowned.
What the hell is the Iron Syndicate?
Gavin shrugged. Can't say exactly. MI6 was referencing it in regards to Afghan heroin, Libyan man pads, and human trafficking in Malawi. But they didn't have anything else.
Holy cow. A global criminal enterprise that large, and I've never even heard of it.
I kept digging around, but couldn't find anything else. CIA, DIA, all dead ends. So I put some bots together a couple hours ago and sent them off into the net on their own to bird dog this thing. They haven't turned up anything yet, but I hope to get something by the end of day.
Hope? That doesn't sound like you.
That's what's freaking me out. These Iron Syndicate guys are good at hiding secrets. Like, government-level good.
You think this Iron Syndicate is a foreign agency?
Not really. More like a private outfit would be my guess. But given the quality of the OPSEC...
Jerry sat up. Rogue foreign intel officers. Rogue or retired? Or both.
What would connect heroin, arms, and human trafficking?
Money, Gavin said. It's all lucrative stuff.
That's why I think it's private enterprise, not some kind of government-sanctioned thing.
You think, but you're not certain.
Intel agencies have done the same kind of thing, even worse. So I can't be sure.
You're right. We can't be.
But Jack's still connected to this somehow, through Elena Iliescu.
Yeah, she wanted to kill him.
A personal vendetta? Or a hired hit for the Iron Syndicate?
Gavin scrolled through his iPad again.
I mean, judging by her travel schedule and her income stream, I'd say she was definitely a professional hitter.
Hired to hit Jack.
Again, I can't be sure at this point. But I broke into her cell network, and of course I have access to Jack's.
Gavin pulled up a screen with a video graphic and slid the iPad over to Jerry.
Jack said the cops told him she'd driven in from Trieste, so I tracked her cell phone starting the day Jack was in London, 11 days ago. You can see her movement around Trieste, and by the timestamp, you can see she picked up and headed to Ljubljana the day after Jack left London.
Gavin reached across the desk and swiped the screen for Jerry, pulling up a new video.
And here you can see Jack's cell pinging in the city, and hers. Notice how closely she stays next to him. Got within 100 feet of him a couple times.
So she was definitely tracking him, Jerry said.
No question.
And she followed him up to... where was it?
Kozyak Falls. And actually, she got there ahead of him by about 2 hours. Here.
Gavin picked up the tablet and scrolled to another page and showed him.
Jerry examined the tablet.
She knew where he was going.
Maybe she tapped a phone or got a bug planted somewhere. But it wasn't an accident she bumped into Jack up there.
Gavin cleared his throat. perfect place for a hit, especially if she planned on beheading him. I mean, not that I've ever done that sort of thing.
Jerry leaned back in his chair, flipping through Gavin's tablet. The place is pretty remote. He studied a police photo of the crime scene. Picnic bench, ice chest, bone saw.
Let's assume you're right and this woman was hired to kill Jack. We need to find out why.
She would know.
And she isn't talking. At least not officially. Jerry sat up and reached for his laptop. Maybe it's time to arrange an unofficial chat with Ms. Iliescu. Find out more about the Iron Syndicate and why they ordered a hit on Jack. Should we call the feds in on this?
No. We don't have proof of anything yet to give them, and we're still just making educated guesses. Besides, they're going to want to know my intel sources, and neither of us wants that.
Agreed. So what makes you think she'll talk to us?
Assuming she is a pro, that means she's been hired by somebody for a chunk of cash. By not filing charges against Jack, she might be sending a signal that she's looking for more money.
Jerry woke up his computer and pulled up a list of phone numbers.
On the other hand, she failed her assignment, and that means she's in trouble with her employers. So my guess is she might be looking for protection. Either way, I know just the guy who can suss it out.
Jerry dialed a number, then held up a finger toward Gavin.
Excuse me for one second.
Of course.
Gavin's eyes drifted to the photographs of the ex-senator posing with presidents, kings, movie stars, and business titans over the years. The most prominent one featured Jerry and President Ryan, close friends for many years and co-founders of the campus and Hendley Associates. A few rings later, someone picked up on the other end.
Dom, it's Jerry. I have an assignment for you. Might make a nice little vacation for you and Adara. And Midas, too, come to think of it. I'll set up a conference call from my end and fill in the details.
Jerry hung up and turned to Gavin.
Nice work, Gav. I'll keep you in the loop. In the meantime, keep digging around for whatever you can find on this Iron Syndicate.
If the Syndicate knows she failed her hit, you know they'll send somebody else for Jack.
I told Jack that. But he says he's got something to finish before he can come back where we can keep an eye on him.
Gavin frowned with worry. The fact we've never heard of these Iron Syndicate people makes me extremely nervous.
I'm worried, too. That's why we've got to find out what's really going on, and who's behind it.
Chapter 25. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Jack met the apartment owners briefly, a charming young Bosniak couple, both high school teachers, who showed him around the spotless two-bedroom apartment decked out in IKEA furniture and local art. They left him a set of keys and a couple maps, along with a small pot full of dark, rich ground beans and instructions on how to brew a cup of Bosnian coffee. This was his first Airbnb rental, and he was extremely pleased. Half the price of a hotel and twice as nice. The only bummer was that the building's garbage chute was located on the third floor landing across from his front door. Fortunately, the smell didn't reach inside the apartment. Jack changed into shorts and a linen flannel shirt and headed out, pulling on a pair of Oakleys against the bright sun. He was famished, but fortunately, his first Aida target worked at a restaurant with great TripAdvisor reviews in the Turkish part of the old town. It was about a 10-minute walk from his place. He was looking forward to stretching his legs and seeing Sarajevo up close and personal, and the part of town where he was headed was a pedestrian zone. A few blocks from his apartment, he crossed the Latin Bridge heading north, stopping at the traffic light just as a battered trolley car came screeching to a halt. He glanced across the street and saw the sign on the building, and it suddenly hit him. This was the street corner where Archduke Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated in 1914.
It was a dope slap for sure.
Jack had studied World War I in high school.
He'd watched the grainy film footage of soldiers swarming out of their trenches through barbed wire and mortar fire and into no man's land, only to be machine-gunned down by the thousands, or gassed, or blown apart by concentrated artillery fire. Millions of soldiers and civilians were butchered in a war that served no purpose other than to lay the foundations for the next one, an even bloodier affair. All of that carnage that laid waste to an entire generation, all triggered by the pistol shots of a Bosnian Serb nationalist, fired here. Right here. The assassination was one of the most historically significant events in the past 200 years. The Russian Revolution, the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires, the rise of the United States as a world power, the beginning of the end of the British Empire. Those fatal gunshots also gave rise to Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Franco, Hitler. The whole world crumbled in the earthquake that was the Great War. And this place was the epicenter where it all originated. It was practically hallowed ground, wasn't it? But as Jack glanced around, all he saw were locals marching off to work with cell phones stuck in their ears, frustrated car drivers, a couple old-timers shuffling aimlessly along, teenagers lugging book bags. Their faces were heavy with frustration or fear, or numbed with boredom and fatigue. Just everyday people, trudging through history as casually as they would through a shabby shopping mall. The light turned green and Jack crossed with a woman who tossed her smoldering cigarette onto the street, maybe right at the place where 19-year-old Gavrilo Princip stood and pulled the trigger. To these people, it was all so ordinary and familiar. How could that be? Jack stepped onto the curb and stood in front of the museum commemorating the terrible event. It was just a single room, occupying the bottom floor of a three-story building standing on a corner. He found a plain, simple inscription in Bosansky and English on an unremarkable stone slab on the museum's outer wall. From this place on 28 June 1914, Gavrilo Princip assassinated the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, Franz Ferdinand, and his wife, Sophia. That was it? Unbelievable, Jack thought. He'd seen Chevrolet ads with more emotion. It seemed as if the city was hardly trying to remember this tragedy. Or they were trying to ignore it. Maybe they didn't want to be blamed for all the inconsolable suffering and death that followed. Jack was suddenly as depressed as he was confused. He was tempted to check out the museum, but his gurgling stomach told him to wait until some other time. Jack turned and walked north. With any luck, he'd find the girl and a good meal all at the same time. A few blocks up, and Jack was formally in the old town, his Merrill Moab ventilators clopping on limestone pavement stones smoothed by 300 years of foot traffic. Suddenly the grime of the working-class city behind him was transformed into a Turkish bazaar, the wide streets lined with shops of every kind selling jewelry, clothes, artwork, books, and food. Lots of food. And the streets were suddenly crowded too, mostly tourists. Europeans, certainly, and Asians. But he also saw his first Muslim woman in Sarajevo covered from head to toe, her eyes alone exposed beneath her niqab, walking alongside a bearded Muslim man in Western slacks and a shirt. Were they locals? Tourists? He wasn't sure. He passed by the wall of the Gazi Husrev Beg Mosque with a fountain on the corner where passers-by stooped to drink water from a spigot with their cupped hands. Google Maps steered him left, and 3 minutes later he stood in front of a wrought iron archway opening into a small courtyard between two buildings with wood tables and bench seating jammed with diners. Small, clear electric lights hung from the branches of trees overhanging the courtyard. Bosnian folk music played on the outdoor speakers, but it could hardly be heard over the laughter and loud, friendly banter of people having a good time. There wasn't a breeze of any sort, and Jack felt a small trickle of sweat sliding down his spine as he stood there searching for a place to sit.
The tables were crowded with plates of delicious-looking food and glasses full of wine and beer, and quite a few cigarettes. It was a good vibe, and obviously a popular place. He glanced through the open door of the air-conditioned restaurant interior and saw a standing-room-only crowd inside and no empty tables or even a space to stand at the busy bar. Even if Aida was in there, he wouldn't have the chance to talk to her.
"You want a table? Over there," a waitress said, nodding her ponytailed brunette head toward an empty two-seater in the back of the courtyard while she balanced plates of lamb kebabs and fish. Her left ear was pierced with at least 10 small hoops, and tiny blue star tattoos were clustered on her neck.
"Great, thanks. Is Aida Kurich here?" Jack asked, but the waitress had turned her back to him and was delivering food to an eager table of hungry young Germans.
Jack made his way carefully through the choreographed chaos of flying waitresses, harried busboys, and shuffling tourists passing in and out of the restaurant. He kept his eye peeled for a pretty blonde with blue eyes. He assumed Aida was a waitress, but maybe she was a cook or tended the bar. Gavin's notes weren't that specific. He figured he'd order food and try again to ask whoever his waitress was about her after he ate. It was still early, and he couldn't imagine this Kurich woman would bail out of her shift before the dinner crowd got rolling and the tips started dropping, especially if she was a server. Jack wedged past a bench with a fat Spaniard bulging into the walkway on one side and the gangly legs of a couple tall Finns on the other, then excused himself past three plus-sized women before dropping into the seat behind the small open table he was aiming for. He picked up the menu that was thankfully in English as well as a few other languages, and scanned the selections. Where the hell was the cevapi? The waitress with the ponytail and the fishing tackle on her ear carried bottles of beer wedged between her fingers, dropping them off along the way before reaching Jack's remote location.
"You decide," she asked with a harried smile.
"No cevapi?"
"Not here. Cevapi ginica petitsa peratovich is best."
Jack assumed that was the name of another restaurant. He'd figure it out later.
"What's good here?"
"Bosnian pot. It's a kind of soup. Very local."
"Sounds good. And your best local beer, too, please."
"Okay," she said as she snatched up his menu and scampered off. Jack kept scanning the courtyard while waiting for his order, hoping to catch sight of Aida. He was too far back on the patio to see inside the restaurant. A few minutes later, a giant bowl of soup and a cold bottle of Sarajevska beer arrived. He dug into his bowl greedily, savoring the lean, spicy beef that practically melted in his mouth, along with the soft wedges of potato, sweet onions, and crunchy vegetables in the rich red broth. It was really more like a stew than a soup. He washed it down with the smooth, drinkable lager that tasted especially good and even a little sweet, chasing the soup's mild spices. By the time he spooned up the last bite of soup, his waitress had reappeared with another beer in her hand. "How do you know?" Jack asked. She smiled, her eyes flashing with just a little bit more than professional interest.
"You have the look."
"What look is that? A dumb American?"
"No, just thirsty."
She set the beer down on the table.
"Anything else you want, thirsty American?"
"Yeah, maybe you can help me. Is Aida Kurich here tonight?"
Her interested smile suddenly faded.
"Yes?"
"Do you mind asking her to come over here?"
"She's busy."
"It's important." She shrugged, resigned to her disappointment and clearly annoyed.
"I will tell her."
Jack watched her bobbing ponytail disappear into the restaurant. A minute later, a pretty young blonde appeared, followed by a man with a close-shaved head and a serious addiction to weightlifting, and quite possibly steroids, to judge from the unnatural shape of his upper body. The blonde approached his table. The man stood behind her, glowering at Jack over her shoulder. A few heads turned to watch the show unfolding. The woman's piercing blue eyes narrowed and her small mouth curled with a question.
"You asked for me?
You're Aida Kurich?"
"Obviously. Is there something you need?"
Jack ignored the hulk behind her, his nostrils flaring.
Jack had the feeling that if he waved his handkerchief, the guy would start pawing the ground and charge him.
I'm sorry to bother you, Ms. Kurich. I tried calling earlier, but nobody picked up. My name is Jack Ryan, and I think I'm looking for you.
She frowned with confusion at the strangely worded statement.
Sorry?
I'm looking for a young woman about your age who was injured years ago in the war. Her name was Aida Kurich, and my birth name is Lulich. She nodded to one side, indicating the goon behind her. She raised her left hand and flashed a diamond wedding band. My husband's name is Kurich. So is mine now.
Well, then you can't be the Aida Kurich I'm looking for. Sorry to have bothered you.
Anything else? She asked.
My check, please.
Jack drained his beer waiting for the check, leaving cash and an enormous tip for the trouble he'd caused and his slight embarrassment. He now realized this little adventure was fraught with a few more challenges than he'd anticipated. At least the beer and the Bosnian pot were good.
Near Biokovo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The small idyllic farm was surrounded on three sides by gently sloping forested hills and bounded by a burbling creek that ran all year except for the winters when it froze. The traditional whitewashed one-story house appeared gray in the quarter moon, and the red roof tiles grayer still. The sturdy barn stood nearby, topped with cedar shingles slathered in moss. Part of the meadow was surrounded by a stack rail fence to accommodate three milk cows, and another part was a neatly groomed truck garden behind the house, plowed by a sway-backed horse now bedded down in the barn with the cows for the night. The squad of black uniformed men approached from out of the tree line, with red checkered Croat militia Crusader Knights unit patches sewn on the sleeves. They carried suppressed AK-74UB long guns with night vision optics, far more firepower than what they needed for this operation. But it wasn't the elderly Serb farmers inside the house they were worried about. Tarik Burkic was kitted out like the others, but didn't wear a balaclava. No need. He remained in the tree line 100 meters back, and thanks to his blinded white eye, used a Gen 3 night vision monocular to supervise the operation. He watched as flashbangs flared and popped inside the farmhouse, and a moment later came the dull flash and muffled chatter of suppressed small arms firing. The only scream that arose was snuffed out in another short burst. Four of his men dragged the bodies onto the lawn and splayed them out in a row, a slaughtered choir robed in blood. "Don't forget the note," Burkic whispered in his comms, staring through his monocular. The ghosted green hand of his number two reached into a coat pocket and held the envelope high. The envelope and the letter inside both bore the dreaded crossed swords and red-checkered shield of the infamous Crusader Knights militia. "Got it," he replied in Berkic's earpiece as he pinned the note to the old man's bullet-ridden nightshirt. Burkic also heard three dull pops in his ear. Three more of his men in the barn had just dispatched the animals in short order. But the crack of a branch behind him caught the big Chechen by surprise. He whipped around, scanning the trees with his one good eye. 3 meters away, pale moonlight illumined a barefoot Serbian boy in nightclothes staring at him, his wide eyes fixated on the Chechen's rifle. The boy was about the same age and height as his own seventh son. He even looked like him. The boy's eyes locked with his. Burkic recognized the horrified shudder. His milk-white eye did that to children, even the ones who knew him. Burkic smiled, gesturing the boy forward with a gloved hand. "Everything is going to be okay." The boy stood frozen in place, trembling. His terrified face grew brighter in the rising yellow light of a roaring fire far behind Burkic's shoulder. But it was the scream of the burning horse that made the boy suddenly gasp. The flickering catchlight of the fire danced in the boy's dark eyes in the clear German optics of the Chechen's rifle. A muffled pop and the spray of black blood behind the child's head ended his terror. His body crumbled to the ground like a puppet when its strings are cut, crunching in the pine needles where it fell, as the first of his men thundered up behind him. "Who was that?" one of them asked,
Time to go, was all Berkich said. 10 minutes later they were in their vehicles and far away, long before the fire would even be noticed or reported. Red Wing had called for sharper measures, Berkich thought, as they sped along the two-lane road. Tonight, they had delivered, with evidence left behind to spread the tale of Croatian crimes, written in blood and lead. And the corpse of a nameless boy. Berkich prayed his parents would find him before the rats did. Inshallah. Chapter 26. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. After his embarrassing first attempt at finding his mother's Aida Kuric, Jack decided to try working the phones harder and avoiding personal contact. He came to realize that if a Bosnian appeared out of nowhere and walked into his office at Hendley Associates and asked if he was Jack Ryan, he'd be suspicious as hell. Before he went to bed, he dove into his first 3 calls. They were nearly as awkward as the encounter earlier in the evening had been, but he played the bumbling American role pretty well, apologizing after every question and acknowledging that what he was doing was strange. All 3 calls were strikeouts, but he was encouraged. He showered and hit the sack early, determined to make a day of it tomorrow. After a cup of steaming hot Jocko white tea, he made his first 2 phone calls for the day. They went faster and felt less awkward than the previous ones, and also resulted in 2 more names getting crossed off the list. 6 down, 5 to go. He popped on the news and caught the local weather. Cool this morning, but it was going to be another warm and perfect day. No point in staying cooped up in the apartment. He decided he could make his calls from a breakfast joint just as well. He'd noticed the day before that he was the only guy on the street wearing shorts. He wondered if that was a cultural thing, or even a taboo. But then again, it was brisk this morning, so pants made sense, and it made him look just a little more professional. He found a TripAdvisor review for a place on the edge of the old town and dropped in. The small restaurant was crowded with people grabbing coffee and pastries to go. Jack spotted a seat by the window and beelined for it. He took the advice of one of the TripAdvisor commenters and ordered a Bosnian coffee and a crunchy chocolate hazelnut pastry called a pita. The donut-shaped pastry was phyllo dough, and the dense, gooey filling tasted like Nutella. Full of fat, sugar, and countless carbs, the flaky pastry might have been the best damn thing he'd ever eaten. Knowing he'd have to run at least an extra 10 miles next week to burn off the additional calories, he passed on getting a second pita and instead ordered another cup of dark, rich Bosnian coffee, smoother and less harsh than a full espresso, and sweetened with 2 small sugar cubes, Bosnian style. Fortified with sugar and caffeine and happy to people watch through the big picture window, Jack began his next round of calls. The next Aida, number 7, was a harried bank clerk who assured him in no uncertain terms he had the wrong person, and number 8's mother informed him her daughter had immigrated to Australia 2 weeks ago. But he sounded like a nice man, she said, and she had a lovely daughter named Amina, who worked as a bookkeeper, and perhaps he would like to meet her. Number 9 was unemployed and living at home with her parents, and, unfortunately, she wasn't the one he was looking for either, she said in the form of an apology. The 10th call was not only nice, but sympathetic, and even though she wasn't the woman he was looking for, offered her services to help him in his search. Jack thanked her, but politely declined. 1 Aida left. Despite his failure so far, he was encouraged. Nearly everyone he spoke with this morning was not only nice, but even understanding. He picked up the phone and dialed the number, but it went straight to voicemail in Bosanski. He hated leaving voicemails in his own language, let alone with such a strange request, so he hung up. He double-checked the address of her employment and discovered she worked in a bookstore just a few blocks away. Jack paid his bill and tip with cash and headed out the door. Within 20 feet, he was out of the pedestrian part of the old town and walking down one of the main thoroughfares bisecting the capital city, Marsala Tito, Marshal Tito Street. bustling with traffic and pedestrians. It felt like a downtown street of any large American city, except for the minarets in the distance and the noticeable lack of skyscrapers. He reached the bookstore in no time, a modern European-style shop featuring children's books in several languages in the large picture window. The young woman behind the counter greeted him with a warm smile. Her name tag identified her as Aida Kuric, as well as the store manager. A thick lick of blonde hair peeked out beneath her fashionable pink-patterned headscarf. She spoke softly and with an accent somewhat different from what he'd heard before. But she was extraordinarily polite and even interested in meeting him, possibly because no one else was in the store and she was bored. After handing her his business card, he noticed that her left eye tended toward an outward drift, something that could have been caused by an injury. His hopes rose. This might well be the woman he'd been searching for. But he didn't feel comfortable asking the shy young woman about her lazy eye, and he was glad he hadn't when she informed him she had moved to Sarajevo from Izmir, Turkey, only in the past year. She explained to him that there were as many Bosniaks living in Turkey as there were in Bosnia itself, and that Turks and Bosniaks both here and in Turkey thought more highly of one another than they did of Americans. She assured him she did not mean this as an insult. He assured her he didn't take it that way and thanked her for her time, trying desperately to hide his disappointment behind his practiced smile. Time to return to his apartment and regroup. Jack marched back down the street past the corner of the assassination and caught himself almost missing it because he was running through options in his brain about next steps. Discouraged as he was that all 11 Aidas didn't pan out, he was more determined than ever to see if he could still find her. But how? It was 6 hours earlier in Virginia and way too early to call Gavin, but he had a couple ideas. As he was crossing the Latin Bridge, it suddenly occurred to him that there was something else about Bookstore Aida that caught his eye. The lick of blonde hair strategically located on her forehead was very blonde. So much so, he wondered if it was natural. By the time he jogged up the staircase 2 steps at a time and opened the apartment's heavy steel door, he'd already composed an email to Gavin in his mind. After hitting the head and washing up, he opened up his laptop and logged on to the apartment Wi-Fi and Google searched a factoid he seemed to recall about blondes. He then composed the email, first of all thanking Gavin for the outstanding list of names, which unfortunately didn't pan out. So would he mind putting together another list for him? This time, searching for brown-haired women instead. To drive home the point, he added a link to an article he found and explained to Gavin that a lot of young women who were blonde when they're children find that their hair turns brown or chestnut just before they enter puberty. He signed off with, "Let me know your thoughts, and thanks again." Jack was a huge fan of Gavin's, even though the tubby IT genius was kind of a smartass. He knew Gavin was covered up to his eyeballs in work, and he knew he was asking him to go the extra mile. But Gavin was his best shot at finding the elusive Aida Kuric. He hit the send button and went to the living room to check out the local TV, always a great window into any culture. He flipped through a dozen channels. They were all American programs, mostly reality shows, with a few familiar cop and medical dramas, all in English but with subtitles. No wonder everybody around here spoke good English. The only reality show he ever watched was on there, too, Forged in Fire, where bladesmiths and farriers competed to forge iconic combat swords from history. But he hadn't come to Sarajevo to watch American television. He kept searching until he could find true local programming, and that was a news show. It wasn't in English, and it didn't have English subtitles. But the shaky, handheld footage of covered bodies on the grass and cops swarming around what looked like the smoldering ruins of a barn told him all he needed to know. Bad shit happens here, too. Chapter 27. Since Gavin probably wouldn't be responding for a while, Jack decided to venture back out and do some sightseeing, and finally find a place to grab some cevapi for lunch. Jack decided that the first place he wanted to check out was the Assassination Museum. He followed his familiar route to the Latin Bridge. From his Google search on the plane to London, he'd learned that Sarajevo was 80% Muslim, so he presumed that 8 out of 10 people he passed were Muslims. There were a half dozen women in very casual headscarves, like the one bookstore Aida wore, but far more women wore nothing on their heads, and some were dressed scandalously. Same with the men. Jeans, soccer shirts, polos. There was nothing to indicate their religious affiliations at all, save for the one old man he saw shuffling along, his hands clasped behind his back, prayer beads rolling absent-mindedly through his fingers. It was always exciting for Jack to find himself in a new country and a new culture. He tried to drink in everything he saw and encountered, down to the smallest detail. He was on vacation, not an op, but he was trained to be observant. Situational awareness was the first and best form of self-defense, and that meant being aware of one's surroundings and the people in them. As it turned out, that skill set came in really handy on vacations. And though he couldn't be sure, the man in the sport coat and Ray-Bans seemed to be tracking him from a discreet distance, and doing so better than most. Or maybe not. Sometimes his training made him paranoid. Jack crossed the bridge and the traffic light and entered the modest little museum, paying about $6 American at the small ticket window inside. He could stand in one place and glance around the room and see just about everything, but since he bought the ticket, he decided to take advantage of the exhibits. The subject matter covered more than just the assassination, depicting life in Sarajevo from 1878 to 1918. It started with a display of immaculate breech-loading rifles with ivory inlay from the 19th-century revolt against the Ottoman Turks. He proceeded on to some furniture displays, singing competition medals, famous mustachioed administrators, and other random slice-of-life presentations. What really caught Jack's eye were the two life-sized mannequins depicting the Archduke and his wife in their regalia. The only other people in the little museum were 4 teenage kids bowing and curtsying before the royal couple, half clowning around and, in a way, not. One of the girls politely asked Jack if he'd take a photo of them doing that again, so he grabbed her Samsung Galaxy phone and snapped a couple shots as they repeated their genuflections. On the other side of the creepy mannequins was the glass box display that he'd come to see. The first thing that grabbed his attention was the picture of the assassin, Gavrilo Princip, the 19-year-old Bosnian Serb who killed the couple and sparked a Holocaust. The guy didn't look like a fiery revolutionary, or a thoughtful ideologue, or even very bright. Apparently, he was too short to be accepted into regular military service. There was nothing in his eyes, or his stature, or his looks that drew your attention. He was just an ordinary kid with a thin mustache and a bad haircut. But unlike other teenagers his age, he had the blood of millions on his hands, or at least the blood of 2 people he considered oppressors. Maybe Princip read Jefferson just as Ho Chi Minh had, quoting Jefferson in stinging rebuke of his American enemies during the Vietnam War. The Serbian assassin wanted what every nationalist wanted, freedom and independence for his people from the oppression of foreign powers. No wonder a lot of Serbs still considered him a hero, but to everyone else, he was just another terrorist. The other thing that really grabbed Jack's attention was the pistol on display, with the claim that it was the weapon Princip had used to carry out the murders. What struck Jack was how completely unremarkable it was, almost primitive, even for those days. Jack knew enough about the actual event, with its multiple failures and incredible coincidences, to believe that God or history or some other force had decided that Ferdinand was supposed to die that day, no matter what. Jack's moment of philosophical musing was interrupted by the phone vibrating in his pocket. It was Gavin. Having seen enough, he stepped outside into the warm sunlight. "Hey, Gavin, kind of early for you, isn't it?" Gavin yawned on the other end of the line. "I was just hot-dropping my frigate through a wormhole." "Excuse me?" "Eve Online, dude. You should play." "Thanks for calling, Gav. You got my email, I take it.
Sure did.
Sorry that of the list didn't work out. There were some real cuties.
Any chance you at least got a date or two out of it?
Jack laughed.
Not exactly why I'm here, but thanks anyway.
So do you think you can pull another list